The Women of Ill Repute, with your hosts, Wendy Mesley and Maureen Holloway.
Wendy, our guest this week is Johanna Schneller. I'm going to tell you right out of the gate, I have resume envy.
Well, I kind of get it. Johanna Schneller, she is one of the top entertainment journalists in the world. I read her, of course, in the Globe and Mail, but she's also written for every major magazine, Vanity Fair, GQ, In Style.
Ladies Home Journal. I didn't know the ladies still had a home journal.
Or that there were still ladies.
But... Well, that's questionable. She's profiled every big star you can imagine. Like, and you name them, Brad Pitt, Robert Downey Jr., Liam Neeson, Julia Roberts.
Yeah, well, I want to ask her about that because apparently there's a thing. But anyway, Johanna, she's president of the Toronto Film Critics Association.
She's a screenwriter. She's written at least 4 major adapted screenplays.
She's hosted several TV series about film, of course, The Filmmakers for CBC. And she also did TVO's Saturday Night of the Movies. Maybe she's still, anyway, we'll have to ask her.
Big shoes there. Also, apart from film, Johanna has co-written books about Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, transgender cyclist Kristen Worley, and most recently, The Last Doctor, Lessons in Living from the Front Lines of Medical Assistance in Dying.
Yeah, and Johanna, she's married to another great writer, Ian Brown. They have 2 kids, including Walker, who was born with a rare and super serious genetic disorder. So we can maybe talk about that.
Johanna and Ian have been very upfront about that. So when we spoke earlier, Johanna said, what are we going to talk about? My response is, well, what aren't we going to talk about? Apparently we can talk about anything under the sun.
Yeah. So this week, it happens to coincide with the Academy Awards. You're an expert on all. Well, you're both experts on that. So maybe we should start with that. What do you think?
I think that's up to the multifaceted and highly accomplished Johanna Schneller. Hello, Johanna.
Hello. It's so nice to see you both.
It was funny. We were just saying that you are the interviewer and here we are. You're now in the being interviewed and it's odd, isn't it?
Yes. It's funny to have the tables flip. It's actually a good humbling exercise to do every now and then because it reminds you of what you're actually asking other people to put themselves through for you. So
yeah.
My pleasure to be here.
We've got so much ground to cover, but as Wendy said, the Academy Awards, they're, as usual, highly contentious, political, terrible snubs, surprise nominations. Let's just start with out of the 10 films that were nominated for Best Picture. What do you think of the crop this year?
I think it's a really good crop. I think it was a very interesting year. I think that there's a couple of front runners that have emerged now in all of the various Guild Awards and things that we're seeing. You know, my frustration with the Academy Awards and with all awards really is that you get this very diverse, very interesting group of films and then everybody somehow solemnly agrees on the thing that feels like the most serious man movie. And this year the serious man movie is Oppenheimer. And so like it doesn't matter how many things are popping in the corners of here and there and like interesting and fascinating. It's like, but what's really important? You know, what are the men thinking? And then that's where we go, right?
Yeah. So it's Cillian Murphy, or I may have mispronounced that, but I love him. He was in Peaky Blinders and it's the same character in Oppenheimer. It's a great movie. Well, it's not that great, but Mo and I, we've had a couple of fights about Barbie, so we can maybe go there. But yeah, it's the man movie has won over the woman's movie.
Well, the serious man movie, as Johanna puts it, versus the frivolous woman's movie. And in fact, well, let's talk about Barbie because this is considered the biggest snub. Both Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie, who starred and was producer, overlooked. But Ryan Gosling, whom, you know, we love.
He was great. You got to admit, he was wonderful.
Okay, I know. But it's there's an irony involved, the fact that Ken gets a nomination and Barbie and her maker don't.
I think the big picture here is what kinds of, like if we pull the camera way, way back, what kinds of movies do women get money to make? And I think you tend to see more like Justine Triet's movie, Anatomy of a Fall, or Celine Song's movie, Past Lives.
They're incredible.
But they're made on a smaller scale. And so when it comes time to honor the director of these movies, it's like they're small, they're a little, But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then the woman doesn't get the big budget the next time either, or the next time after that. And as a result, you have an Academy Awards that in 80 years has nominated like 5 women.
But it was a big, it was a huge deal, the Barbie movie. Like, to me, it was full feminism. We can talk about that because Mo doesn't agree. But it was huge. Like, everybody dressed up and everybody went to see it, and it made millions. So even when it's huge, you can't get a director's award as a woman?
Yeah, even when it's huge, it's still a girly movie about a doll. You know, I mean, that's the perception. Really, I think everybody can cast their mind back to the summer when both of those movies came out on the same day and there was the Barbenheimer phenomenon. And I am really surprised that more people from Oppenheimer haven't actually thanked Barbie in their acceptance speeches, because I think far fewer people would have gone to see Oppenheimer if it hadn't been rolled into that Barbenheimer phenomenon. And it just, to me, that's the irony of it all. Barbie did this tremendous box office. She carried this other movie along in her wake. And then at the end of the day, she's the one. It's like, that's enough out of you, little lady. Sit down and let the serious people have their turn now. So it's not so much for me, like, is it Greta or is it, you know, some other woman who didn't get nominated? It's women, capital W, who don't get nominated. And that is becoming increasingly frustrating for me.
The Academy Awards, which are still the pinnacle of, and you're right, there's just been such a plethora of award shows now that it's somewhat diminished, but still, they are the most important. But sometimes when I'm watching them, I don't think I've missed one in my entire life. I used to watch them when I was a little girl, no idea, you know, who Sam Peckinpah was, but I would watch the Academy Awards just because they were so glamorous. And yet I still say to myself, what the hell? Why are we celebrating these people? Like, you know, the Nobel Prizes don't get this kind of, and this, I guess I'm widening the observation / question to the fact that what is wrong with us? We're celebrity obsessed. Never before in history have we cared so much about such, frankly, not important people.
You know, I write celebrity profiles, as you very kindly mentioned. And the way I always justified it is that they are sort of our Greek gods. They're our little pantheon of, and, you know, we want to see what Zeus and Hera and Aphrodite and all of these people are up to. And I think they're interesting because, like, all of us believe that we should be living bigger lives, right? Like, we all think that we were sort of destined for greatness or something, but something gets in our way. We don't have the money. We don't have the time. We don't have the connections. We don't have the access. So if you present me with a handful of people who have all the money in the world, all the access, all the beauty in the world, and then you say, what is your life like? Is your life better or worse than mine if you have all of these things? I think that's inherently what's so interesting about them, because I think that they provide this kind of basis for comparison. If you had all the obstacles in your life removed, would you still have trouble in your marriage? Would you still have, you know, problematic children? Would you still be dissatisfied? And the answer is yes. So I think they serve a function for us, whether or not it's the function we think they're serving.
It's interesting because I think now with the Kardashians and whatever, that we all think that we're all celebrity obsessed. But as Mo was saying, we've always been celebrity obsessed. So there is something going on. It's just changing.
It also brings us together. When we get, you can meet a total stranger and you can have a conversation about George Clooney with them. So it is a unifying force as well.
That's right. I think they give us permission to talk about our own lives. Like, I think if you go like, oh my God, I saw this thing where Goldie Hawn said that happiness is a choice. And do you think happiness is a choice? You know, and then you have like a little window into something you might not have had a conversation about. Like, why do I care that Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck are seeming to make it work this time around, you know, like they've been through the ringer and by God, here they are, they're trying it again. You know, I just think that that's an opportunity for us to talk about ourselves, whether we realize that or not.
Well, in your columns, a recurring theme is girl power. And we talked about that with the, you know, the man movies and the serious man movies and Barbie and so on. And so are we getting somewhere? Like, is anything changing? Like, the whole Me Too thing happened, but it sort of sounds like we're still in the same rut. Are we getting anywhere?
Are we getting anywhere? I mean, there are more, like, if we wanted to turn it back to the Oscars, 3 of the 7 films that are nominated for Best Picture this year were directed by women. That's the most that we've ever had. That's at one hand, a hopeful thing, and on the other hand, a ridiculous thing. Because last time I checked, women were not one third of the population of planet Earth. So, you know, it's a very slow moving ship to turn around. People with power never want to give up power. I'm hopeful that more things are changing. And the evidence I see of this is that in Hollywood these days, you know, there are boxes to tick. You have to have a certain amount of diversity. You have to have a certain amount of people who are differently abled. You have to have people of color. You have to have more women. And I think that's working. I think it might have started as a box to tick, but what is happening is that we are actually seeing more movies. We're seeing in Canada, we're seeing a lot more stories about Indigenous lives were made by Indigenous people. There's this idea now that you couldn't possibly make a movie about a Black family or an Indigenous family without having at least one Black creator involved in the proceedings. I think all of those things are good things. I think it's just very incremental change.
You wrote a piece last weekend in the Globe and Mail on Mean Girls, which I was in grad school 20 years ago, a late bloomer, and I wrote a paper on Mean Girls. It had just come out. And so it was interesting reading your article about how it holds up 20 years later. And it does in all its various incarnations, because girls will always be mean. There will always be mean girls. And I thought it was really interesting. And my point 20 years ago, maybe my point today, is that the very meanness of girls, the fact that they can be mean and specific and funny. The movie's very funny. The lines are fantastic. It's actually, I called it intra-female complicity or something. I can't remember, some pretentious thing that I had in my paper. But the fact that girls have a code, women have a code, whether it's good or, and it isn't about being nice and it isn't about being kind and maternal and all those wonderful things that are ascribed to being female. It's being witty and manipulative and, in other words, mean. And I was wondering, what do you think about that?
Well, there's this old adage that if the patriarchy's having dinner and they're just like tossing the scraps off the table and all the women are fighting for the scraps that they're getting tossed, then they're going to be more aggressive to one another. This idea that Tina Fey wrote about when she was at Saturday Night Live. Tina Fey, obviously the person who wrote the movie Mean Girls. At Saturday Night Live, she basically said they would sort of say like, ooh, there's another woman writer coming. And what are you going to do? Or, you know, we have our girl. Do we need another girl? Like, and they never pit the men against one another in that way. There was not that encouragement of what the book that Mean Girls is based on calls relational aggression. There's this idea that like dudes will be dudes and they can all just carry each other along. Whereas women are just like never going to be able to do that. And I think that what the author of the book, So Fetch, which is about the making of Mean Girls, I got to speak to her for that column you mentioned. And she basically said that women need power on some level because power is what makes us feel secure. And if the only power that we can have is power over another woman or over our peer group, then we'll take it. But because it's kind of a pale power, the only power that we can get. And the more power we get, I think you see the more women lifting one another up. I think that the Me Too movement was a perfect example of that, that all these women who were meant to feel like you weren't allowed to talk about it, once they started talking about it together, they could make change working on the same side. I just heard an interview on NPR with Lily Ledbetter, who was a worker at the Goodyear Tire Plant in Tennessee or somewhere like that. And they told her she was not allowed to discuss her salary with anybody else. And she found out, of course, through like secret notes that people put in one another's lockers, that her salary was 30% less than the guys who were doing the exact same job as she was. And she put her job on the line. And in fact, they fired her to sort of create this Equal Pay Act that is also having an anniversary in the States now. But she points out that it doesn't just affect your salary in the moment. It affects your pension. It affects your Social Security, all those things that come on down the line. So there's a whole lot of forces out there that don't want women to unite and talk to each other, that are very interested in keeping women at each other's throats.
It's really interesting. It makes me think of something that I mentioned in the intro, which is Julia Roberts. But it sort of fits with the whole thing. Like, I think we actually are getting somewhere, and not just in terms of diversity, but in terms of everybody getting ahead and everybody saying, I will support you and let's share the power and whatever, and not just the the old boys. But Julia Roberts, I just find it fascinating because you were saying, my husband calls them girls who like throw plates, throat players or plate throwers, that they're way more interesting. And your suspicion of Julia Roberts was that she was a plate thrower and that she was actually more interesting, but she wanted to be seen as the nice girl next door and the pretty whatever. So where are we?
What happened? I'm missing. What happened with Julia Roberts? Did she throw a plate at you?
God, I wish she had thrown a plate at me. No. Now, I want to preface all of this by saying that I interviewed her many, many years ago, pre-children, pre the person that she's with. So she might be a changed person. But in the couple of times that I interviewed her, I think it was three times, once for GQ, once for TV Guide, I can't remember what the third one was. She was definitely, and again, looking at this now in a new light, this is probably what like she felt she had to do, but she was much, 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 much more charming to men than she was to women. She was much, much more charming. And she understood how to work it. The movie that I interviewed her for TV Guide was a thing on PBS where celebrities went and interacted with animals. And there was one where Robin Williams did elephants, and it was a kind of way of calling attention to these endangered animals. Julia Roberts did orangutans somewhere in Central America. And I got to talk to the director, and he said all the men on the crew were in love with her, and she made all the women cry. So, you know, I think, again, that's just a person who had this sense of what was going to get her ahead and what wasn't going to get her ahead. And that all might be different now. But at the time that I encountered her, she was a bit of a mean girl.
Hey there. Just so you know, Mo and I are not just the queens of podcasting.
I'm not sure we're even that, but do go on.
We're not part-time cowgirls.
We just made that up.
But we are writers. We're writers.
Wendy and I write a newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly roundup of thoughts and experiences, sometimes serious, often not.
Yeah, you're pretty funny. You write about falling down a lot. You write about your dog.
I do. You write about sex and politics and COVID.
All very, very serious things. We have a few thousand subscribers, both free and paid.
And you could be one of them if you'd like. Just go to Substack.com. And look us up by name or go to our website at womenofillrepute.com and sign up there. We'd love to meet you there.
And now back to being the queens of podcasting.
Yeah, sure.
The Women of Ill Repute.
And I talked to you personally before we did this interview, Johanna, about this, about so doing celebrity interviews. And I understand, and Wendy understands, there's a huge difference between a celebrity red carpet type of who are you wearing reporter and an arts journalist. And I wonder, you know, you're so, and I'm not blowing sunshine up your skirt here. You are accomplished. You are a screenwriter yourself. You are a writer. You are not there. You're there to actually do an in-depth profile. And I would think anybody who knows anything about you would be flattered that you are looking at them that way. But you must have people who dismiss you because they're famous and you're just some other person who comes along and you don't really understand what they do. And you just want to know, you know, who they're seeing. And I mean, does that happen? Do you have to sort of impress upon people that you're quite serious?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you're very kind. Thank you so much. Not to like dwell on Julia because this wasn't Julia's fault, but part of the cover story that I did for GQ magazine was she was getting her photo taken by Herb Ritz, who was a very famous Hollywood photographer. And they were doing a shoot on the roof of his studio in Hollywood. And Herb had at the time these two dogs that were these very exotic, beautiful looking dogs called Rhodesian Ridgebacks. And I was on the roof watching the whole proceedings with my little tiny tape recorder. And, you know, Herb was there with 77 people. And there was a person whose job was like to go like this.
Just flick at her. Yeah.
You know, to make sure that everything was hanging right on the wardrobe. And there were people handing him his camera and handing him his lights and doing his lights and da, 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 da. And I was with the dogs. And every person who walked by said hello to the dogs. Hello, dog. Oh. Hello, dog. And not a single person asked me who I was. And that experience happened very early in my career writing celebrity profiles. And that was very instructive for me. And I tried to always remain humble, but I had a sort of second experience a couple years after that. I was interviewing Liam Neeson in Scotland for the movie Rob Roy for the cover of Vanity Fair. And the shoot, not to anybody's fault, just like weather and certain conditions and stuff, the shoot was not going well. So everybody was quite tense. And I'm on the set in like remote Scotland where they're shooting this movie. And so they keep putting off my time to interview Liam. It's going to be tomorrow. It's going to be the next day. The clock is ticking. And, you know, it's my first story I've ever written for Vanity Fair. So I'm super nervous about it. And like, I'm calling my editor and my editor's calling his agent. And anyway, we finally sit down for this interview and he is unbelievably crabby, like unbelievably crabby. And I'm very disappointed because I'm like half in love with him and he's, you know, this fabulous creature in my eyes. And anyway, I'm on the plane home and I'm like, I'm going to write a story about him. He can't do anything about it now.
Yeah.
It's in my hands now. Like he's actually ceded the power to me now. And sure enough, when I got home, there was a message waiting for me. It was Liam. He was like, oh my God, I felt like I really didn't do you justice. And let's have some phone interviews now. And he gave me a couple of phone interviews. And then when the story came out, he sent me another note saying like, you really could have been meaner to me and you weren't. And somewhere when I was on that plane, he also realized like, oh, she's going to write this story and it doesn't matter what I didn't say, you know, or like it's out of his hands. And so I think that's what's so interesting about the phenomenon of what's happening with celebrities now and social media. People don't want to sit down with you. Like you very kindly said they should, you know, be happy that I'm writing, but they are not happy that I'm writing about them. They do not care about my 1,000 words in the Globe and Mail because they would rather have their 40 words on Insta where they get to say what they want and they don't have a person like me mediating them for the world. They're presenting what they want to present. The stuff that looks raw that they're sending out there isn't raw, as we all know. It looks raw enough that it satisfies their fan base. And so you get people like Beyonce, never given an interview. She does what she wants.
Well, and they don't need to anymore, right? They don't need the conventional media anymore. So yeah, I know when I was at CBC, Q was allowed an interview and the Globe and Mail was allowed an interview. And those were the two people who got more than 10 minutes. Otherwise, it was everybody just shove through and don't ask this and don't ask that. Don't ask about the love affair. Don't ask about the whatever. And they get away with it. So I just like, how do you figure out, how do you make it real without sort of stepping on a line and making somebody grabby? It's such a game.
I know. I would come home from an interview and I'd be like, he's great, or she's so fun. And Ian, my husband, would say, they're actors. I believed that I could see through them enough to kind of get a glimpse of what they were really like. And that was a function of time. You know, back in the dark ages in 1984, when I started doing this, I was working at GQ magazine and they had barely begun putting celebrities on the cover. It always used to be models. And the same was true for Vogue and the same was true for Vanity Fair. Like the idea of celebrity journalism was kind of brand new. And so there was no Entertainment Weekly. We had a lot of power in terms of, you know, if you wanted to be on the cover of GQ magazine back then, you had to agree to sit down for three different interviews, one in your home, one at work, and one somewhere out in public. And you had to spend like an hour with each of those at each of those interviews. And then there was a whole separate set of getting photographed. And people did it because it was, you know, the best way to get your message across in a kind of glamorous way.
Now you just go on social media.
Social media. Or at TIFF, for example, at the Toronto International Film Festival, you can't get an interview with anybody anymore because they're off in the photo suites getting their photos taken, because that photograph is going to get reprinted and transmitted out into the world a million more times than any one individual story. And they feel like they can get more traction with that. And it's time better spent with them for that. So, you know, so it's a different kind of access we're getting to celebrities now. It's a much more curated by them access. But some people would say they're getting more access because, you know, when the celebrity lets you into their house, when John Legend is like tickling Chrissy Teigen, you know, you feel like you're seeing something that you wouldn't have seen if a journalist was present. So it's a trade-off.
And yet, you know, Vanity Fair and GQ, they still have these you're still doing profiles. I want to ask you rather, I mean, we're always tempted to say, who's the worst person you ever interviewed? But
my favorite question. I hate being asked that question. So,
but I want to ask, and that's happened to me and Wendy as well, where sometimes you cut through. Sometimes you go, and I've interviewed so many musicians, especially in hotel rooms, particularly when I was younger and I'd get asked out for dinner, but I'm not talking about that. I'd be more like, I remember Rita Coolidge of all people going, I love your top. Where'd you buy it? And I said, down the street. She said, could we go shopping? I mean, sometimes we didn't, by the way, but sometimes you cut through. Sometimes you connect. And I wonder if that's happened to you and with whom.
Yeah, I do think that's true. I think that sometimes you know, I think it would be really, really hard. You'd have to be not very good at your job, I think, to sit with somebody, even for 10 minutes, and not have some single moment where you've had some kind of like meeting of the minds, or you've said something that, you know, they liked, or they've said something that you liked. Like, you have to hope that at heart, people are people. And if they're not, then you have to hope that you have the wherewithal to see that. And then you've at least got that part of the story. Like, this person's Teflon and they never drop their facade for a second. But I would say, yes, I hope they feel the same way. I felt like I had a connection over the years with Emma Thompson. I just love her so much.
Because we're all connected to Emma. I've never met her, but we're deeply connected.
I'm sure she knows.
She's her best friend. And, you know, when people say, who is as great as you want them to be? She's as great as you imagine. That is how great she is. She is great. And whether she's faking it or not, she seems to remember that we've talked before, and she seems to remember about what. And she's just phenomenal, and she's funny, and she's forthright, and she has no time to waste, and she's spectacular.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, she's spectacular. And I had a couple of really good conversations with Julianne Moore. Super smart, very empathic person. And you mentioned my son Walker at the beginning of this, and I was interviewing Annette Bening at a very emotional moment in my life. It was kind of when we found out what was going on with Walker and what it would mean for the future. And so one of my little tricks is, does a person ever ask you about yourself, especially in the longer interviews? If you're spending an hour with someone and they never ask you a single question about yourself, then I think, I have a little insight into your character, right? The smart ones will ask you a million questions about yourself because that means less time for them to talk about themselves, and they're just frittering away your time. That's a tactic. That's a different thing. But if they ask you one sincere question or two sincere questions, then I think, okay, you're a human and we're connecting on a human. So Annette Bening says to me, how many kids do you have? And I'm just at that moment where, like, I know if I say I have two, then they say, what are they like? And I'm thinking, do I want to answer these questions about Walker? And I just don't know. And so for some reason, I told her the truth. She said, how many kids do you have? And I said, one. But to be honest with you, I just found out this thing and I don't even know how to talk about him yet. So let's just, and so we moved on.
So he was a baby. He was a baby.
He was like two. And so we moved on and da 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 da. And then I had been told a million times she has a heart out. She has to pick up her kids at school. She has to be out by three, blah, blah, blah. So at 2:59, I say to her, you know, thank you so much. I really love talking to you. And I turned off the tape recorder and she said, now listen, tell me about your son. And it was so sweet. Like, it was just such a human thing. And she sort of sat there for another 20 minutes and we talked like mother to mother. And it wasn't for the story. But it meant the world to me. And so, like, I will always, you know, if anybody says, who's the greatest person you ever met, it's like, she's right up there for just because of that human quality. Yeah.
How is he doing?
Oh, thank you. I would say he's pretty good. He's 27 now. He's been living in a group home for 15 years. We love them. They're fantastic. It's called the Stewart Homes, and they're based in Pickering and Peterborough. He's in a place in Pickering. But the pandemic was really hard on all of them and continues to be really hard. Like, one of the great things about this group home was that it got the kids out into the world. And they would go to the mall and they'd go to Boy Scouts. I'd be like, what is Walker doing at Boy Scouts? They were like, doesn't matter. And, you know, he went to school on the bus and he had kids who looked after him. And, you know, the Boy Scouts, I think, got something out of hanging out with him, probably more than he got out of hanging out with them. But anyway, the pandemic comes and, like, boom, that's it. it's over. Like, they're in their rooms, they're with their one-on-one caregivers, nobody's talking, nobody's going anywhere. And you could just feel the whole, every one of those, he lives in a place with eight other kids, and you could just feel them all sink. They just all sank. And the caregivers did the best they could to keep that from happening. But, you know, it's a golden thread these kids are sort of hanging by. And then we had this really heart-wrenching, it's hard to describe how heart-wrenching it was, first encounter with Walker during the pandemic, because for months we weren't allowed to go and see him. And they tried to show him us on the iPads, and he doesn't care about that stuff. He doesn't know what he's looking at. So we would like, hey, Walker, but it didn't matter. It's the first time we're allowed to go see him in person. It's been, I want to say, 7 or 8 months. And I keep saying to Ian, does he think we died? Does he think we don't care about him anymore? Does he have any sense of how much time has gone by? So we go visit him. We have to wear full PPE, shields, masks, this, that. We can only meet him outside, and we're not allowed to touch him. And he is not demonstrative, but he sees us and he runs to us, and we have to back up. We can't touch him. So we do this horrible little dance where he's coming to us and we're backing up, and he's coming to us and we're backing up. And finally, he just goes, and he sinks to his knees and cries. And then we sat down and cried too. And then they said, that's your 20 minutes. And we went like, all the way home. I said to Ian, I don't even know what that was. That was so horrible. I can't even explain what that was. And I wish I had defied the caregivers and just like bumped into him or something. I wish I had just been able to my shoulder making contact with his shoulder, because what would it have done, right? But this was pre-vaccine and we didn't know where anything was going to go. And there was nothing we could do. So that's a long way of saying it's been a hard couple of years for us and him. But when he sees us, he's, you know, happy to see us. He now can come home again and we can go back and forth and things are getting back on track. But it's been, I think, like most of us who have children, we won't know the impact of whatever age they were during this pandemic. We won't know for a couple of years.
Yeah. And did he know did he know that it was COVID that meant you couldn't hug him? No.
He would have no sense of being able to know what that was. Like, yeah, they were just, and now still to this day, they're getting it. It's still, people are getting it and they'll get it at his house. And then everybody goes back to their room and they try not to give it to each other. Like it's just, for everyone, it's an ongoing difficulty, but I think for these kids with special needs, it's just a whole other level that we don't think about very much of how difficult it is. If you can't explain it to someone.
You and Ian have been so forthcoming about it. I've read you both through the years for all the other things you write about it, but especially this. And I hope it helps you both to deal with it by being so open about it, because it's certainly inspiring to other people. And you know, I have deep, obviously, because I'm a mess, I have deep empathy for that.
You know what I think it was good for? I think it was good because before it was a book, The Boy in the Moon was a series of articles in the Globe and Mail. And it happened that they were running in December and we were going to a lot of Christmas parties. And so we'd go to one of these Christmas parties and whichever of the three installments had just come out in the Globe, and people would be like, oh my God, I read about Walker and except for our very closest friends, a lot of people in our lives didn't really know the extent of everything that was going on with Walker. So it was new information for a lot of people and everybody was super kind about it. But what would happen every time is they would say, you know, like, I've got an uncle who's an alcoholic, or my brother's kid is in real trouble. And I realized that everyone is carrying around something that they're not talking about. And it's heavy. And when you give somebody permission to talk about the thing they're not talking about, there, something happens between people. We'd come home from those Christmas parties with like pounding headaches, like, oh my God, that was so, like, I heard 15 stories that I would never have heard otherwise. Like, it was so profound. And so I do think anytime anybody shares any kind of story about that, anything that they're struggling with in their life, it does help people because we just are, we're trained to be like, we're fine. How you doing? I'm fine. You know, it's really hard to say anything other than fine. So I like to think that it helped people talk to each other about stuff.
Mo and I both have kids, 25 and 30. And it's a remarkable thing. And I think Maureen and I have both been fairly open about things, bad things that have happened in our life. But it's hard because, as you say, so many people, they don't want to go there. And you and Ian don't want to go there and talk about Walker all the time either. So how, like, all of this to say is I think people need to be a little bit more open than they are. And you have been so open about your son. So
I'm sure it informs you as a writer and an interviewer too. I think I'm like, what is it about Johanna Schneller that people want to talk to her? And I think it's because you yourself have empathy. And even if people don't, even if they think you're with the dogs, which is what I think you should call your memoir, I'm with the dogs, the Rottweilers or whatever.
The dogs have names. Yeah.
I think that there's something about you that people want to, they want to connect with you. So keep up the good work, for lack of a better expression. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I mean, you two must have your ways of getting people to talk. And I mean, one of my ways of getting people to talk isn't as nefarious as it sounds. It's just genuine. It's like, if I ask somebody about their parents' divorce, I'll be like, well, my parents got divorced and it was like this. It was like this for me. How was it for you? There are people who think you should never do that in the course of an interview, right? That you should just be like a shrink. And that's never been my way of going about it. I don't know if you know this writer, Taffy Brodesser Ackner, who writes for the New York Times Sunday Magazine and wrote Fleischman Is in Trouble. Half of her stories are about herself. And that's her way in. Like, she just gets people talking because she's just so yappy and fabulous. And I've interviewed her for a couple of things. And I just am like, oh, I'm so in love with her because she's just so yappy and fabulous. So I think, yeah, somewhere you have to let your own personality come out if it's going to be a real exchange.
I'm just looking at the clock and we've been talking for more than half an hour. Yeah.
I know. Oh my God.
Johanna, you're wonderful to talk to. We have so many more questions, but we could probably talk for hours. And I remember seeing you, I don't know whether you were doing CBC or what you were doing. You were in the makeup chair and I was too shy to say hello, which is so stupid. Like, here I am. I was probably a little bit in a rush or overworked or overwhelmed, but my main thing was I was too shy. So it's really, really nice to meet you. I feel like I know you from reading you and Ian and from reading the story about Walker over and over and over again. So it's been so nice. Yeah.
Yeah. We've been fangirling for a long time. So thank you for coming on and talking to us. We really appreciate it.
Right back at both of you. You're both spectacular and I will happily talk to you anytime.
All right. We'll hold Thanks, you to that. Anna. Well, as an interviewer, she's a fabulous interviewee.
Yeah. No,
she's written books on MAID, on medically assisted death. She's written by Rob Ford. I mean, movies aren't even the half of it.
Yeah. I just, there was so much to talk about with her son, let alone all the celebrities, let alone all the books that she's written. I remember, and I had to confess to seeing her in the makeup chair and being too stupid, really, to go over and say, hi, I'm a big fan and you're wonderful. And I remember her husband walking down the street with Walker, and he would have been 2 or 3 years old at the time. And I knew that there was an issue, but it was way before Boy in the Moon was written. It was way before the Globe series about his severe genetic disorder.
He's never evolved past, if you haven't picked up on, he has not evolved past the mental age of two, but is cared for and loved. And what can you do?
Yeah. So she's wonderful and he's wonderful and they've been through something really hard and they've, not that you can ever figure out everything. No. Some things just mark you forever. But she's a great thinker.
And yeah. A funny, both she and Ian are like hilarious. And so, I mean, you can be all things and I'm really a big fan.
Women of Ill Repute was written and produced by Maureen Holloway and Wendy Mesley, with the help from the team at the Sound Off Media Company and producer Yet Belgraver.
I'm Connie Teeson, the host of Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast. We focus on Canada and the challenges facing Canadian radio and TV, as well as highlighting those moving the industry forward from podcasting and streaming to new broadcast tech. Check us out at broadcastdialogue.com or your favorite podcast app.